What were some of those challenges of, you know, modernizing and growing the safety culture across the companies?
The biggest challenge is safety is an attitude.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't care what anybody says. All the gadgets in the world, AI, all that, safety is an attitude.
Yep.
I don't care what you have and that stuff, things don't make you safer. Your attitude towards safety makes you safer.
Yep.
Funny enough, so like safety, as a firefighter and that stuff, you're going to assume a certain amount of risk.
Yep.
Kind of have to, right? It's just the nature of the job. So you learn how to mitigate those hazards,
right,
and that stuff. While to some degree, you're sacrificing a bit of safety. And that, like, you're gonna put yourself in harm's way sometimes. So in this role that I'm in now, I've kind of had to stop thinking like that. You know, you don't have to assume certain risks. You have to identify those risks.
Yes.
You have to figure out how to mitigate them without putting yourself at risk. We either evolve or you start losing these contracts.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the podcast Caution Wide Right, brought to you by Compliance Navigation Specialists. I'm Luke, your host. And today, on Veterans Day, we have a truly special conversation lined up. Our guest is Ken Goss, a truck driver, retired firefighter and EMT, and currently safety manager at George A. Kent Incorporated, as well as board member of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, secretary of the South Central Chapter, SMC board member, and serves on the Chapter Relations Committee. Ken has spent decades serving others, whether from emergency response and transportation or behind the scenes improving workplace safety. Today, we're focusing on something close to all our hearts, Wreaths Across America, the national initiative that honors fallen veterans by placing wreaths on their graves while also teaching the values of service and freedom to future generations. We'll talk about how the trucking industry supports this important mission, the logistics behind it, and Ken's personal reflections on service, safety, and leadership. Ken, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Before we dive into work and volunteer efforts, man, you've worn a lot of hats in your career. I mean, you've been firefighter, EMT, safety manager. You've got your cowboy hat right there across the way.
All the time.
What originally sparked your passion for service and safety?
So 1987 was a defining moment in my life. In January of 1987, Dad was killed in a truck accident, heading back to the yard on a Saturday morning. At the time, I was living with him. I'd only been living with him for 6 months at that particular moment. Having grown up in a broken home and an abusive home and that stuff, like, my dad had made significant changes in that stuff. So in the summer of 86, I decided I wanted to go live with him. And I did. God obviously had a plan there, and that, because I ended up meeting my wife. My dad and her dad worked together. So I moved back to Williamsport. Obviously, as a 14, 15-year-old who just lost his dad, like, you know, it was rough waters to navigate.
I'm sure.
So to speak. My mom was dating somebody at the time. They would go on to get married in, I think it was August of that year. And then we ended up moving from Williamsport to a little village called Allenwood, south of Williamsport. So now I'm at my 13th school since kindergarten.
Been there.
Whole new set of friends and that stuff. But my new stepdad was the fire chief at the volunteer fire department there. And, you know, we kind of got off to a rocky start. Like, I was angry at the world for losing my dad and everything else. And what then was my girlfriend, who ended up becoming my wife. Like, my whole world just kind of got, like, when it seemed like it was stabilizing, then boom,
yeah,
it's not. So decided to join the department. So they had a junior firefighter program. So I was able to join 3 months prior to my 16th birthday and figured it was a way for us to connect,
yeah.
You know, and, little did I know, again, going to change my whole world and that stuff, like go down there. I fell in love with it. Just the whole community aspect of it,
you
know, especially when you're in such a small village and that everybody knows everybody, everybody knows everything about everybody, you know, so it was, basically learn how to be an adult on the fly, so to speak. That was what my 1987 was. So,
and then did that transition to the sort of the emergency response and the firefighting, the safety oriented? I know you mentioned, you know, previously that you've, you know, did some court reporting and other things around other sort of, you know, workers' comp and things, which sort of goes into the safety manager role that you see that you face today. But is there sort of a transition there that you've sort of seen or growth in that over time?
The one thing, like I've always only ever identified as a firefighter or an EMT or both, you know, it becomes such an ingrained part of your life, whether you're a volunteer or career firefighter and that stuff, like you end up engrossing yourself into that profession.
Yep.
And, it, like I said, it helped me grow as a person, as, you know, my teenage years weren't normal teenage years. And that would reflect later on in life as, you know, things kind of played out. You learn so much in that service. Like there's so many things that you can take from that.
Yeah.
And that, like, it's not just the safety part of it, but, and especially, and funny enough, so like safety as a firefighter and that stuff, you're going to assume a certain amount of risk.
Yep.
You kind of have to, right? Yep. I mean, that's just the nature of the job. So you learn how to mitigate those hazards and that stuff. While to some degree, you're sacrificing a bit of safety. And that, like, you're going to put yourself in harm's way sometimes. So in this role that I'm in now, I've kind of had to stop thinking like that. You know, you don't have to assume certain risks. You have to identify those risks.
Yes.
And you have to figure out how to mitigate them without putting yourself at risk.
Yep.
So I guess there's some parallels. Like I've taken maybe not something out of it, but what not to do out of it.
Sure. Totally. And then with your career, you know, you've mentioned, you know, mentorship and leadership, people that have influenced you throughout your career. I know on social media you've mentioned, I believe, Chief Bryson's impact on you, and I'm just curious about what were some of those impacts and how has that sort of grown you as a person to today?
So as a junior firefighter growing up in the department, that stuff, Chief Bryson was my first chief. Still navigating the waters of my relationship with my stepdad at the those formative years. So he was the one that, you know, I ended up kind of bonding with and that. The man had so much knowledge about the way he was passionate about fire service. And that's what, you know, like ultimately made my passion grow for the fire service and for just helping people in that. He taught me just an immeasurable amount of stuff regarding the fire service as a whole, the science behind firefighting and that, but even more so, we hung out and that, and, you know, it was like having a big brother who just knew everything.
Yeah.
Which, as the oldest brother, you know, I didn't have that. He was my go-to, my person to look up to. And he, you know, he will never know, unfortunately, how much of an impact he had on my life, because I got one opportunity to see him right before he passed. And seeing him there, it had been a while since I'd seen him, and I couldn't formulate a sentence. Like, he kept asking me questions, and I couldn't say anything. I'm looking at the man who I looked up to, and seeing him frail, and then I knew as soon as I opened my mouth, I was going to lose it.
Yep.
And I didn't want to lose it in front of him. So I'm trying, like, holding back tears. I'm like trying not to sound like I'm choked up and everything else. And I wish, you know, hindsight being 2020, I just kept praying that he would see the light and hopefully realize how severe his symptoms were, and he would try to fix it. But I think he knew, he knew where he was. He didn't want to do anything. He was ready to let go and move on. And like I said, hindsight being 2020, I wish I would have just sucked it up and showed some emotion and told him how much he meant to me. So,
well, at least we have it on record a little bit here, and hopefully looking down on us and being able to hear that too is always important. Now, you know, EMT and firefighter, 30 years, transition. I know you did delivery, truck driver. Was some of the trucking stuff associated, like, did you get your CDL while you were a firefighter?
No.
So you did that afterwards?
No. So the first big heavy equipment, whatever you want to call it, that I drove was, we had a 67 and a 69. Engine and tanker.
Yeah.
I don't remember which was which. So he was the one that taught me how to drive a stick. I was the first person ever to spin the tires, backing the tanker into the fire station.
Wow.
And that. And anybody that's driven manual knows that if you don't operate the clutch right, that tends to happen. It's pretty easy to spin the tires, even on a tanker.
Yep.
I got my CDL when I was working for Interstate Batteries in the early 2000s. And then I kept my CDL when I went to work in the oil field in 2007. I used it out there for driving, large, I drove wireline truck, cranes.
Wow.
Had my hazmat to haul radioactive materials, explosives. And then when I got out of the oil field, I used it to deliver milk, and I went to work for a drive-away company, and so I used to haul all kinds of vehicles all across the country and take them from point A to point B, and then hope that I could pick up another truck to go somewhere else, and did that for a couple of years, and then I went to work for Republic Services. Did that for a while, and then I went to work building power lines out in West Texas. Back to doing the driveway thing for a little bit until I decided to get back into the EMT field, and that went to work for an EMT company full time.
And then what transitioned you to George A. Kent? And I know there's a lot of fire service or fire extinguishers and different things there. They have a beverage company. So how's that? What does that transition look like?
So 2017, we lost my daughter called me when I was headed to work. I wasn't even 2 minutes from the house when she called, and she had delivered her second daughter prematurely at home that morning and didn't make it.
Yep.
And it was like a switch flipped. And I couldn't do it anymore. So November of 2017, I'd gotten depressed. I'd gone to therapy, everything else. But I couldn't shake it. So I had an opportunity where I was going to end my life. And the day before that, I called my brother because I was filling out an application to go work for a county down there as a dispatcher, and I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And that, but I'm going through the motions because I know I've got one day, I've got one opportunity to put an end to it all. As I'm talking to him, he kind of understood what was going on. Like, he offered me a job. He's like, you know, we're hiring. I'm like, my wife's never going to move back to Pennsylvania. Like, we love it in Texas. She loves it in Texas. She's not coming back. And I said, you know, I'll talk to her tonight. I'll ask her. And we went to bed that night. I brought it up. And she said, I think it would be good for you to move back, to be closer to family and that, and help you deal with this. And then I'm legit shocked to the point, like, we just lay in bed there crying, like, this is gonna happen. And then for the next few months, it was every need that we had was met to get us back here. And that's how I ended up Kent. So I started as a fire technician. The one thing that I always said during that 6 month period was, if I'm not a firefighter or an EMT, then what am I? Because I've devoted 3/4 of my life to this service. And that was the part that I think played the most into my emotions, into the whole PTSD thing. And then, because I didn't know who am I?
Yep.
If I'm not this, then what am I? So, being able to come up here and work for Kent in the fire division, it gave me an opportunity to learn a different side of fire protection, different side of firefighting, one that I thought I knew, and one within a month realized I knew nothing about. There are so many fire extinguishers and so much that goes into this, like rules, regulations, and compliance, and this and that. It's like, holy.
Where they're at, why are they there?
Yeah, it's like, this is like a whole new world to me. And then that got me excited. Now I'm like, God, I love to learn.
Yeah.
Power is, you know, knowledge is power, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I engrossed myself in it. And it was like breathing new life into me at that point, because now I had a new purpose and I had a new thing. And then what was it, 22? They came to me and asked me, they wanted to create a safety role at the company and asked me if I'd be interested in it. And at first I was like, And it wasn't because I didn't want to do it. It was more like I just spent the last 3 years basically rebuilding an area of our service area.
Right.
And built all these relationships with these customers and we like each other. And that, and I like going to them, and you know, it's like, man, like, who do I turn this over to, man? I just, I just fixed this. Like, now I'm like, I don't want to give my baby up. No. So, after some conversations and prayer and whatnot, I agreed to do it, but under the condition that I could do both.
Right.
And that, like, because I was not giving up my customer base. And then it got to be entirely, like, when we first started this. It
comes a lot. Quick.
So my brother is the GM at Kent, and he had told me flat out, like, he didn't think this was a 40-hour week job. The owner did.
Was this, because it was started as a beverage company first, too, right?
So, yeah, George A. Kent started as a beverage company in 1954. And
you were just focused on the fire division.
Yeah. Well, that's all I worked in was the fire division.
Right, right.
And it is amazing. Like, they're two very distinct things. So Kent Fire Protection and Beverage Concepts they're two different divisions housed in the same building.
Yep.
But it's like nobody knows each other.
Yeah.
They know each other by face and name. But what do?
Yeah.
And that. So I had to, when I moved into safety, now I've got, what does beverage do? And that. What exactly? And it seemed so taboo because it was like fire guy talking to the beverage guy. Uh-huh. Like,
It's a cultural change a little bit there too then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, again, there was an opportunity there to, we always seem to kind of treat the two as two different entities, but they're not. Like, we're all the same company.
Yep.
And that afforded me an opportunity to promote the fact that, hey, look, guys, I don't care what you think you are. We are one company. We are George A. Kent Incorporated.
Yep.
We have divisions, but we're one company.
Yep.
And you have to start looking at that way. Like, it can't be this side gets to do this, this side doesn't. No. It doesn't work that way.
So on the safety side, so you started it from the ground up. It sounds like managing it, and then it's eventually grown to you've earned a gold safety award from Highwire, improving the ISN score. What were some of those challenges of modernizing and growing the safety culture across the companies?
The biggest challenge is safety is an attitude.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't care what anybody says. All the gadgets in the world, AI, all that, safety is an attitude.
Yep.
I don't care what you have and that stuff, things don't make you safer. Your attitude towards safety makes you safer.
Yep.
So combating this is the way we've always done things, that's not the way we did it in the past, I don't care. Like, y'all don't pay attention to that. And now I'm in a position where I have to pay attention to that. So yep. Let me explain this to you. We either evolve or you start losing these contracts.
Yeah.
These scores have to improve. There are certain compliance things that we're not doing that we have to do. So get on board or
yeah,
whatever. When I got on there, we had either barely passing grades or failing grades across the board.
Yeah.
And then it was just a matter of going down through why are we deficient.
Yep.
And fixing the deficiencies, which is exactly what we do on the fire side and the beverage side.
Yep.
Every day. We talk about, you hear the word deficiency at least a couple dozen times a day, and that's a fix the deficiency, note the deficiency, fix it. And that's what I did. Just knuckle down, and I spent more time in 1910 in the first year and a half that I was there than I ever thought I would in my life. Just learning how bad things were, like the things that we didn't do, we needed to do, we needed to fix, and that, and then just nose the grindstone, just get it done.
Exactly. And I know, so obviously, you're doing the research, you're improving, starting to understand the regulations, but then it comes to a point of also being like, well, man, even these regulations don't make sense, or the new ones that are coming out, I don't like this, or it needs to be changed in some way. I'm curious, OSHA's heat injury prevention, been pushing that for the last couple of years. What was your focus? I believe you were tackling that, trying to change that up a bit to be reflective more of maybe what it could be or should be. Well, how do you tackle that or approach that?
I don't even remember how I ended up on the Sabrefa panel for that. But I did. My first one was in the summer of 23. And sat in my first Sabrefa panel. They talked about the proposal. The Small Business Administration puts these on. And for those that don't know, the Small Business Administration's purpose is to basically try and protect small business, right, mm-hmm. from overburdensome regulations and so on and so forth. So the initial HIP that they put out, they're going through this, and the number was 78 degrees. It was the trigger point. Having lived all over this country, I'm like, that doesn't make sense. How can you have a singular trigger point for the entire country? We have four distinct climate zones in this country. Okay, next. Next is the acclimatization process. Well, if you're in construction, which is what this was geared towards,
right,
and that you're going to be on a specific site, for however long it takes to construct what you're constructing, acclimatization makes sense, right?
Right.
I don't agree with the trigger point, but that's fine. Makes sense. But in our industry, how am I going to govern the whole 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 rule when somebody comes back or somebody was exposed, you know,
yeah,
to an upper trigger limit and that? And like, that doesn't make sense. Having worked in industries where, you know, if our linemen were up in a bucket truck and that stuff, oh, yeah, you got to come down and take a 15-minute break. Guess we'll just drop the line and,
right,
you know, whatever, right? Like, it doesn't work that way. Then we move on to my the final part, the one that I love the most. So OSHA consults with industry professionals whenever they promulgate a rule.
Yep.
Part of that initial one required you having a tub on site, and I believe it was 15 pounds of ice, so that if anybody was in a heat emergency, you were supposed to rapidly cool,
yeah,
the heat stroke patient by putting them in a tub filled with ice water. As a retired emergency professional, we were not allowed to do that,
yeah,
in the field. And there's a very distinct reason, because if you take take somebody that's in one, put them in the other,
it's a shock.
You're going to put them in shock.
Yeah.
You don't treat shock in the field. You can treat it in the hospital.
Right.
They can do things in the hospital that we can't do in the field. Now, take away the whole trained emergency professional part of that, and now you're just going to have a layperson,
yep,
who knows nothing about first aid. Hey, Bob, you look a little red. Jump in this tub of water. That's not going to go over very well. And I'm like, how do you not know this?
Right.
And like, I've had people argue this to me on forums and stuff. Like, it's called the taco method. I don't care what it's called. You can call it whatever you want. I'm sick of acronyms, all right? Like, call it whatever you want. You can't treat shock in the field,
yeah,
okay? You can in the hospital, and I'm sure that's who OSHA consulted. They consulted doctors and that,
sure,
stuff who aren't trained in emergency medicine. They're trained in hospital medicine.
Yep.
They are two distinct things.
Yep.
And that. And now you're asking a layperson with no training, yeah, just throw Bob in the water. It'll be all right. He'll be fine. There's other ways to mitigate this. And I told them, you know, like in the pre-hospital setting, you got temperature points on your body,
right?
Ice packs and that in the armpits, the neck, the groin, you know, wherever there's a temporal point, cool that. You'll still rapidly cool the patient and that without causing life-threatening shock.
Right.
So,
hey, at least, you know, having a voice and making it, I mean, it's, you know, well, we can transition to the trucking industry and how you got joined the PMTA, but like the same thing with the trucking regs that we see all the time. Like, it's easy to be the trucker that just complains on, you know, X or whatever, wherever you're complaining at, but it's just like, man, go voice it. Go,
right,
you know, the comment period's up. You got 90 days. Go say something. Give reasons why. And at least gives you a reason to, you know, yeah, hey, at least I said something. Maybe we move something like that. I am curious. So, you know, you're safety, compliance, you know, OSHA and MSHA and all the others. What got you back into sort of trucking regulations and Pennsylvania Motor Trucker Association?
Come to find out, we joined, I think it was like 2017, because they helped us with some regulatory questions and,
sure,
that stuff. Now, that's all well and good, but now we're 5 years later and that stuff, so why are we still a member of PMTA? We only have 7 commercial vehicles, so to speak. Doesn't make sense. So I go to a meeting and that. Okay, so I'm intrigued. Go to another meeting. Then I go to my first AMC was the one in Bedford.
Okay.
And that. And it's just me. So thankfully, I knew Kelly. So anybody,
yeah,
remembers Kelly Hawthorne?
Yep.
Kelly just kept pushing me. Like, to engage with people. And I'm like, I don't want to engage. Like, I just want to sit here in my table and just kind of like not be noticed, so to speak. And I had Ed Nielsen, who's a state rep out of the Philly area. He was one of the three-member panel that spoke at AMC that year. And I ended up sitting next to him at dinner. And we had a fantastic conversation. So if you would have told me that I would go to Bedford, PA, and have a good conversation with a Democrat, I would have been like, no, it's not going to happen.
Yep.
But I did. And he's a funny individual. He's engaging in that stuff, and that kind of broke me out of my shell. And then I realized, like, this is the purpose, right? So PM, I always told everybody, PMTA is your best advocate.
Yes.
And that, right? Yep. But then there's so much more than that.
PMTA, one of the other things that they, of course, also do, and we're talking about service in a lot of different ways, but, of course, Wreaths Across America is a big thing that I know Pennsylvania and the state trucking associations are a big support of. Truck driving championships, TDC, they bring the mobile unit around, and you know, it's a great way of the trucking industry being able to honor the military veterans who passed away in service. And so PMTA has the Wreaths Across America program. Can you touch a little bit about what that program looks like and ways that PMTA helps out and trucking industry helps out?
Yeah, so Wreaths Across America partners with all 50 state trucking associations, like 300 plus carriers.
Yeah.
And that to put this on, especially this time of year. You know, this is the time of year that gets the most focus, and that obviously, you know, people associate Wreaths with Christmas, so on and so forth. But the reality is, I mean, this is a yearly thing. Wreaths Across America has boomed into a year-round, you know, mission to remember the fallen, honor those that served, and teach why this is important, why our freedoms are important, and the people that fought for those freedoms, and why it's important to honor and remember them.
Some of the fun stats, too, like, I mean, it takes 717 truckloads, this was in 2023, 717 truckloads of wreaths, 3.1 million wreaths delivered across the United States and overseas as well. 332 different carrier partners delivering these loads, and it takes volunteers a part of that. So I'm so grateful for the trucking industry on this side of this to also see and recognize the need for this. I mean, I know truckers who have said, you know, this is the ultimate, you know, most important load that I deliver each year.
Last year we were able to be able to raise enough money across the United States and world that we covered 3,100,000 soldiers' graves on the 13th of December, hoping to do better than that this year. In 92, he had 5,000 wreaths left over and he wanted to do some good with them. So what he did was he took those wreaths and went to Arlington. 12 volunteers went with him, and they put out 5,000 wreaths. So the growth of the business is, you grew in 2022, you grew 500 different cemeteries. You did it again, 500 different cemeteries. Last year we did 684 new cemeteries. So we're growing all the time. The number of wreaths was the same,
but just expanding the locations, more representation.
Expanding the locations, yes. And so we needed more people to donate the wreaths to different cemeteries to get all the veterans covered.
Where do the wreaths come from?
They come from Columbia Falls, Maine, is where they come from. They all come off of his land.
Wow, okay.
So he has a lot of land, and that's all balsa fir.
Yeah.
So he only tips 1/3 of his land.
Yeah.
And the other 2/3 of his land are left for the next year. So every 3 years, he goes to a different section and he clips a tree. So that leaves the tree 3 years to grow new
branches
and stuff, and then they go and tip it by hand.
Wow.
And then they make the wreaths by hand, and then they offload the boxes by hand. Then someone takes them out of the box by hand, and then some volunteer grabs it, takes it to a grave, says the name of the soldier, and places that at the soldier's grave as a thank you. We have this belief that you die twice.
Yeah.
Once when you take your last breath, and the second time when no one says your name.
Yes, sir.
So if we can continue to lay wreaths at soldiers' graves where we can find them and say their name, they're still with us.
So obviously, you know, you need trucks to move goods. The wreaths in Maine aren't going to just, you know, walk themselves down to Arlington or to the 5,000 I think it's 5,000 plus cemeteries.
5,100 cemeteries. Yep.
So, you need trucks to bring them down and that stuff. So Wreaths Across America partnered with all the trucking associations. You sponsor a wreath for $17, $5 of that $17 goes to the state trucking association. Yep. They turn it into kind of a friendly competition, whether it's meant to be or not. And that, it's a great way to cross promote each other. The
exactly.
importance of trucks, the you know, the importance of military service, the importance of your freedoms, and
yes.
so on and so forth. To fill a truck is between 45 and 5,000 wreaths.
Yep.
I'm an overachiever, so 5,000.
Yeah.
Right. That's the primary goal. We as an organization have turn that into a chapter challenge, and you know, chapters sells the most, gets bragging rights. In Delaware or Philly, Delaware Valley, like doubled us up. And Dave Sparrow, who again another great individual, who does great work for that chapter. You know, they come out like we naively thought we had this, you know. It was like it was going to be, I think it was us, Lehigh, and Northwest.
Yeah.
And then Dave's over there like, we got a party in December, we got this. And like, you know, no worries. So then the final numbers came out. We finished second in a tie with Jersey. I think it was 507 wreaths each. And I thought, oh, that's not bad. I mean, it's nowhere close to 5,000.
Right.
But it's not bad. Then I see what Indiana does, and I'm like, yeah, we're not losing to Indiana.
Yeah.
Like, no. Like, forget no. We're not, no. So after last year's challenge, I'm like, we need to promote this. Like, you know, you miss every shot that you do not take.
Yep.
Right. So I'm shooting for 5,000. If we get it, great. If we don't, I'm going to try again next year.
So, yeah, Wreaths Across America. I mean, I served, or my dad served 30 years in the military. I like to say I served 18 years as a military dependent, because we moved as family. That's the other thing with military. You don't think about the families that move, leave friendships behind, make up new friendships. I always like to say it's like, I'm good at making friends, but not deep friendships, because I know I have to.
And that's the thing. The thing about that, right? So I'm 53 years old.
Yeah.
I've moved 41 times in my life. Okay. Like I said, I went to 13 different schools between kindergarten and that.
Yep.
I was bred to make friends.
Yeah.
Like I can talk to anybody.
Yep.
And that I can have conversations. Maybe not deep conversations and that. Maybe not deep relationships like you just said. But my childhood made me that person.
Exactly.
So,
exactly. And that's the way.
Because you had to.
You had to.
You either did it or you lived a very sort of lonely, sad kind of.
And you saw that a lot in the military life. You know, the family member, whether it's your dad or your mom that went overseas or has a 6-month or longer stint away, you know, they're telling their kids to take care of the family. And a lot of times the parent that stays home, they have a choice to make. Can they keep moving on, or are they shutting down? And if they're shut down, then these 10, 12 teenagers are raising the younger brothers and sisters, and so their school career, you can sort of see this transition happen, and they're sort of growing up way too quickly. So it's just everybody has sort of a decision or a way to deal with the military lifestyle. And, you know, I like to, you know, it's easy to, you know, complain, or it's interesting, you know, to think about that. But, you know, Reads Across America is talking about the ultimate sacrifice of, you know, military members that died in service. And, you know, that's why I respect that and the teaching moments of that, because, again, it's the freedom and the, you know, that we have, it takes millions, you know, like what, a million or more people serving all across the, not just the United States, but around the world. I was in Europe, but, you know, all across the world, we have bases, all different types of people. And they're here to help us, you know, just have security that we don't, you know, so many people I talk to don't even think about it. And I think that's, it's partly disappointing, but it's also partly a blessing that they don't even have to think about their safety. And companies that, if you want to get involved, like, that's the easiest way. You know, if you have donations that you like to do, this is another good place to do the donations. You know, you can get a big chunk of that out of the way. Or if, you know, like, if you don't want to volunteer with like a Lowe's, or Lowe's are all taken, you know, that's where the wreaths come in. And then of course you can volunteer as well of going to lay the wreaths. There's tons of locations around that they're going to be laying wreaths at different sites. So again, like I mentioned, we'll have the links in the bio.
CNS Driver Training Center has just changed the status quo and has completely disrupted the current landscape of CDL training. What makes our CDL school diploma programs different? We want to be cost effective and flexible for you, the trainee, not the school. Our Driver Training Center is up to 40% cheaper than competitor programs, which focus on training students in groups, not the one-on-one training like us. Who wants to learn how to be a professional driver crammed in the back of a truck with a group of trainees? Ron, get off of me. We offer classroom and online theory training to better accommodate your availability. We developed this from inception so you have the most impactful learning experience. CNS is the first school to be approved by our state for one-on-one Class A CDL training. Our one-of-a-kind CDL training program is designed with the trainee in mind. How? Because the program is specifically focused on the trainee's current aptitude, learning style, and desired job outcome. We're all about delivering high-quality professional truck drivers to our industry in a timely and cost-effective manner. Trucking jobs will always be in demand, and when you're good behind the wheel, making six figures is easily attainable. So why wouldn't you choose CNS for your CDL training? We are the best in our industry, and our trainees back us up. Just look at all the 5-star Google reviews. If you have further questions about our CDL school diploma programs, or if you work for a company and want to learn more about our company contract training, give us a call at 717-496-9145 or email us at support@cnstrains.com. Or you can fill out the form below and somebody will be in contact with you soon. Our nation needs you to keep America moving.
Beginning of the year, I applied for the safety director position, and they ended up hiring Anthony Cloud. Arguably one of the best hires ever. Like, I know you've met Anthony. Yep. He's such a great individual. Like, if I'm going to lose a job to anybody, I'm losing it to that guy. Like,
he's a good guy. And
yeah. It's like, you know, use a sports metaphor. Like, I'm Michael Vick, you know, losing to, you know, Peyton Manning, you know, or something, you know. Although I'm nowhere near as fast or talented as Michael Vick was, and I don't fight dogs. So, but they have a vision, right? And they got the right man for that job. Like, he's promoting it. He's pushing it. He's getting certs. Like, he'll even tell you, like, he came in this knowing quite a bit, but he's learning so much more, and he knows how to turn that into something tangible for the members of PMTA.
Yes.
And that. And so not only are they the preeminent voice for the trucking industry, but now they're the preeminent source for safety regs and all your DOT needs. You know, we got Wendy in the office and Michelle and Cammy doing the communication part and that stuff.
Yep.
It's such a great organization.
Yeah. Like, and you basically touched the three pieces of PMTA. I mean, it's networking, that's what sort of got you in, communicating with others, and it's a relationship. It's I mean, I always find it fascinating. Like, trucking isn't just trucking companies. It's literally so many, you know, warehousing, construction, no matter, like, beverage companies, egg companies, they all have trucks involved in it. And so the rules and regulations matter, even though maybe you don't think it does as much. I mean, we're in the, you know, our business is in the trucking safety world, too, with the regulations. So it's just like we say it all the time. But, like, yeah, so networking, getting those relationships and building those relationships is so important. Advocacy is the biggest piece that you tend to see with trucking, state of trucking associations. You know, they're on Capitol Hill talking with the congressman on your behalf. That's why you support and join as a membership, so they can go out. Maybe you can go help and volunteer and be in those conversations too. But yeah, they go out and have the ear of the congressmen and women and trying to get the regulations changed on a state level, and then just passing again that knowledge out to everybody. So the safety piece, the knowledge piece, and I always like the PMTA because they're passing the knowledge to trucking companies and companies in general, but even to everyday people. Hey, here's how you drive next to a truck that, right. You know, the blind spots and the important, you know, pieces like that, and going, you know, the road team does an incredible job with the piece of that.
Yeah, and they got so many, you know, Bob Dolan.
Yeah, exactly.
Bernie and, you know, all of them there. Again, there are so many good people at PMTA that are perfect for what they do.
Yep.
And that. So you just got to keep building on it, keep moving forward. And so.
And then, so you said you were sitting at a table sort of, you know, wanting to be quasi left alone to some degree. Now you're on the board, Safety Management Council, you know, the local, our chapter here. Tell me a little bit again about, you know, that process in why that's important to you.
I'm incapable of saying no. So,
which yeah. Of course the PMTA loves. Yeah. They find those people, right?
So I honestly, like, I don't even remember how I became secretary of the South Central chapter. I just know there was an opening for it. I volunteered for it. I got elected to it, and here I am. I volunteered for the chapter relations committee because I love working with Dale Knox. I'm sure you met yeah. Dale. Yeah. Dale is another fantastic. He's one of my favorite human beings on earth. And that. And then SMC was the same way. Like, there, you know, there was calls. So I just started going to meetings and seeing, and then I asked if I could be on the board. And
yeah.
Here I am. And then this earlier this year, I get the phone call from Tom Jakes asking me if I want to be on the state board. And I never thought that was ever even going to be a thing.
Like, right.
I never thought of even asking to be on the board.
Yeah.
I go to the meetings and that, but I just meant the meetings so I could stay on top of what's going on. Like,
yeah.
How can I take, again, I like information, so how can I take that information and use it for our chapter and other things?
So, in the trucking industry, we see a lot of rules and regulation changes. We see a lot of sort of transition over the recent years, technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where do you see, you know, the trucking industry sort of moving, or issues that you find that you want to help tackle or spread the word on specifically?
Well, I mean, my biggest thing was the EV stuff.
Yeah.
Because we had kind of looked into that, like, what we operate mostly, like, Sprinter vans, Transit vans, and that, and then we have some larger vehicles, obviously, but we were looking at, you know, maybe buying a couple to test them out.
Yeah.
The Sprinter van at the time had a range of 140 miles. We service the entire eastern half of Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, northern Delaware, and a good chunk of Maryland.
Yeah.
I could drive to my first stop and have to turn around and go home, right? Like,
yep.
That's not going to work.
Yep.
But, you know, they come up with these ideas and that they put them into place and they don't have the funds, the infrastructure, or in some cases, they don't even have the foggiest idea how to implement it, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's
they still don't have the standard for the trucking charging.
Yeah.
Standard for that yet.
New York was a classic case of that earlier this year, right? Like, okay, you got to start buying EVs and that stuff. Like, that goes into effect now.
Yep.
How many EV chargers are there for trucks in New York?
Yep. And what's the standard for what those charging stations should be? There isn't one yet.
No.
Officially.
And that from the fire side of that,
correct. Right?
The fire science behind EV batteries and even EV chargers is evolving constantly.
Yep.
Like, and they still have not come out with a definitive method for handling that. It's not your typical fire, right?
Right. You can't just spray water on it.
It burns hotter.
Yeah.
It produces toxic gas that, people, the one thing that you're not going to think of, you'll see the smoke, but you won't think about the gas that's in that smoke.
Yep.
And that gas that's in that smoke is what's going to kill you.
Yep.
As is the case in most fires. So there's safety concerns here. And why are we not talking about that?
The idea of moving ahead of the skis is sort of like with legalizing marijuana, in the trucking industry, you want the roads to be safe. A driver can't technically have, marijuana anyway. Federally, it's against the rules, Schedule I drug. But, I mean, when it was rolling it out, when I lived on the West Coast and it was being rolled out for everyday people, and it was like, well, do the cops even have a way of, like with drunk driving, being able to measure anything? Like, are you high at this time? And there wasn't ever anything like that. So, like, why roll out something else to mimic, oh, it's like alcohol, we can, do whatever. Like, you don't have a way to track it. It's like you're ahead of the skis before something that you can fundamentally like double check on for road safety. And EV transition, especially in trucking, it's that same way. It's like, man, when EVs were first starting to be pushed and go out, and it's like firefighters had to deal with this transition on the fly. They're getting better at it, but it's not like you had to force it. It was forced upon almost. Like,
what do they have that, again, the general public does not have? They have gear.
Yeah.
They have resources. Don't.
Yep. Businesses, fleets.
So
you got, as a safety manager, you got to think about what else.
Like,
do you have a charging station too at your place? Like that mentality of like what you need, infrastructure.
There, again, there's so many things, right? I worked in the oil field in Colorado from 07 until 2011, and of course the marijuana thing came. And, some of these guys I don't want to work with sober.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't want to work with them high.
That's the Wild West.
Like, no. They would try to send me up to, what was it, 2008, the Bakken formation really blew up and that stuff, and they were trying to get people to go to North Dakota. It's like, I like my life. No. Oh, how about the Permian Basin in Texas? Yeah, no.
Yep.
No, I'm not doing it.
Well, it's funny. Like, as a safety manager, it's like
I'm white collar oil field. Like, no, I'll stay where it's safe and that stuff. This is about as risky as I care to get.
Yep, I follow some of those forums, and it's like, man.
I got stories about North Dakota and that, and just how when that blew up. Again, you want to talk about not being prepared for something? The infrastructure up there was not ready to see what essentially was a increase by 10 in some cases in population.
Yeah.
And the general public doesn't think about things like that.
Oh, no.
The schools. You don't have the schools. You don't have the sewer. You don't have the water. You don't have the resources to handle that type of influx.
Yeah.
And that you didn't have the houses. People were paying $2,500 a month to live in a literal shed. A shed.
Yeah.
Like you have in your backyard that had a cot, no running water, no electricity. Well, maybe had electricity and that stuff. Because they didn't want to live in a man camp.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And you say Wild Wild West. I mean, that's basically what that is.
Yeah. Safety manager now, going back, thinking about that, I can't even imagine.
No.
And then from like a safety, you know, your safety manager role, if there's someone that's in safety manager thinking about starting a safety management type of role, whether it's in trucking or if it's dealing with OSHA and HR and other pieces, what are some advice of like how to get that started, or how, where should you sort of have your frame of mind, enrolling in that?
Be prepared for kickback.
Yeah.
It's not an endearing role, and that it is a rewarding role if you can get everybody or even the majority to buy into it, and that stuff. Yep. There's so much that goes into it. It's not simply, here's a rule, here's a reg, and that, follow this, do this, whatever. There's the compliance aspect of it. There are tools and that stuff, like different things. Just be prepared to, you've got to want to learn basically every day, because stuff is going to evolve and change every single day. And that you be prepared for that. Like, just mentally accept that your role now is a student.
Yeah.
And that as much as you're a leader and that per se, you're a student, like you're going to have to learn every single day and then you're going to have to pass that information on to your employees, your coworkers, whatever the case may be, even to management.
Yep.
And that you're a teacher, you're a salesperson, you're a student, you're a number of different things. You're going to wear a lot of hats, and you just got to know which one to put on in the morning.
And so, I completely agree with you. It's the getting the buy-in from the top down, because, like, safety is, like you said, it's a mindset. It's got to be company-wide. It's got to be it's a cultural change if it's not something that's taken too seriously. And so it's getting help along the way, because there's going to be speed bumps along the way, having someone behind you to.
That's a great point too. Like, don't be afraid to ask for help.
Yeah.
And that, when I first started this, I used Pennsylvania's LNI site. They do PATHS, what they call PATHS training, PATHS. They every month, almost every day, like Monday through Friday, they put on at least two different topics, sometimes three, four in a day. Great resource. Don't be afraid to reach out to your colleagues and that stuff. Like, if you've got connections in other industries, whether it's similar to yours or not, talk to them. Like, what's it going to hurt? Again, knowledge is power. Or the better you can be effective in what you're doing. So,
and then being involved with different associations where there's different, different rules, different regulations, different networking, different groups, and growing those relationships. And that's key. So if you're thinking about getting involved with something, and trucking is some part associated with it, definitely recommend getting involved with Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. If you're out of state, all states have great trucking associations that we recommend being a part of. And listeners too, of course, if you've got thoughts, questions, you can let us know in the comments below. I'm sure, we'll pass on. If there's questions for Ken, then we'll help answer them. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us, telling us your story, and of course, helping us promote Wreaths Across America. Listeners, again, if you enjoyed the podcast, give us a like, subscribe, and again, let us know if there's any questions that you have. And as always, stay safe out there.